Source inside the NYPD. Not an actual cop or a detective, but a woman in the city's public information office. Barbara had her private cell phone number. She brought up the contact on her own phone and tapped it. Several seconds later, a woman said, "Hey."
"Yeah, hi, it's me. Long time no chat."
"I was starting to feel neglected and relieved at the same time," the woman said.
"Look, I'm trying to nail something down and I'm not getting anywhere yet."
"On what?"
"The elevator accidents on Monday and Tuesday. I'm getting the sense interest in those has gone way up the food chain, but I don't know why. Like maybe Homeland or the FBI is sniffing around? Why the hell would that be happening?"
"If that's true, I haven't heard anything, but
they're like industrial accidents.
But some of the families of the victims have been told to keep a low profile on this, not raise a fuss, so..."
"Shut up and listen."
Barbara paused.
"Okay. It's not two, it's three."
"What?
Are you near a TV?"
"No, I live on Neptune. Of course I'm near.
Turn it on."
Barbara got up out of the kitchen chair and strolled into the living area of her apartment, the cell phone still glued to her ear. She picked up the remote with her free hand, fired up the flat screen, and went to one of the 24-hour news channels. "In 3 days, said a woman with a mic in hand. While Barbara recognized the reporter, Liza Bentley, she did not recognize the building she was standing out front of. But she watched the crawl at the bottom of the screen, which read, "Two dead in 7th Avenue elevator disaster."
"This is not happening,"
Barbara said under her breath.
"You talking to me?" said her source.
"What's going on?" Barbara asked.
"This can't be coincidence."
"Well," the woman said slowly, as if debating if she should continue.
"I did hear something."
Barbara muted the TV.
"What did you hear?"
"There was nothing on paper, no emails. But a lot of calls have been made to landlords."
"Landlords?
Building owners, property managers, that bunch. The word was to keep it on the down low."
"Down low?"
"I've always wanted to say that," the woman said. "Anyway, the city doesn't have enough elevator inspectors to do this on their own, so everyone's been asked to check their buildings."
"For what?"
Barbara asked. "I don't know," she said. "But whatever's happening, a defect or whatever, they're afraid it's going viral."
"Can elevators get a virus?"
"I don't mean it like that." The woman paused.
"Unless, you know, maybe I do.
Thing is, there's more than 60,000 elevators in the city. It's going to take a while to get to all of them."
"Then why not go public?" Barbara asked. "Get the word out. Why haven't you put out a statement?"
"Hey, I just work here. They want to tell the world something, I'm on it."
"Panic," Barbara said.
"What?"
"They don't want to start a panic."
"If there's anything to actually panic about," Barbara laughed. "People don't always need a sound reason to go into panic mode."
"Look, I gotta go.
Let me leave you with one bit of advice, okay? Take the stairs."
39.
"I don't think you can wait any longer,"
Valerie told the mayor.
"You have to say something, a press conference."
Richard Headley was circling his desk, pacing, running his hands slowly over his head.
"Christ," he muttered. "What the hell am I supposed to tell people? Don't use the fucking elevators? In this city? Might as well tell them not to honk their horns."
Valerie nodded sympathetically.
"I know. If we put our heads together, maybe we can come up with something that..."
"And where the hell is Glover?" he asked, stopping and looking at the door, as if expecting his son to walk through it at any second.
"I don't know," Valerie said. "I'll text him."
Headley waved a dismissive hand.
"Never mind. I don't know what help he'd be anyway."
Valerie, who had been standing in the middle of the room, took a step closer.
"Mr. Mayor?"
A pause.
"Richard."
He stopped pacing at the sound of his name, looked at her, and waited.
It may not be my place to speak to this, she said.
I'm sure it isn't, the mayor said.
I say this with the best of intentions. Go ahead, Valerie, just say it. About Glover.
What about Glover?
I think I'm worried about his self-esteem.
The mayor cocked his head slightly to one side. His look bordered on amused. Self-esteem.
I know we talked about this the other day, that his real talents lie in other areas, but you're awfully hard on him. He's trying so hard to please you, but he can't seem to get anything right in your eyes. And I'm not just worried about him. It's you I'm worried about. Why? Things get out. People talk. People observe. Moving forward, we're working very hard to craft an image of you that voters will like.
She cleared her throat.
Like more. They see the way you treat Glover, they form an opinion. That you're, well, something of a bully where your own son is concerned. It doesn't play well.
Headley grunted. Valerie stood a little straighter, steeling herself for the onslaught she thought was probably coming.
Look, you're a complex individual. You can be tough, even cruel, but there is another side to you, and I've seen it. You can be compassionate. I know there are things you care about, the environment for one. But it's not enough to care about the planet. You have to care about the people on it.
Headley looked bemused. Valerie continued.
There are going to be more stories about you moving forward, profiles. We're looking for someone else to ghostwrite your bio now that Barbara Matheson has passed.
Headley snorted derisively. One of Glover's bright ideas.
Maybe it was a better one than we think. She could have done a good job if we'd agreed to give her a bit of leeway.
He shook his head.
As I was saying, there will be more profiles, many of which we'll have no control over, and that means people who work for and with you will be approached. There's a good chance a lot of them will speak off the record, especially if they feel they've been insulted or slighted by you. They'll talk about what they've seen. How you've treated Glover might be one of the things that comes out, and it will reflect badly on you. The fact is, there's already talk about it. There's even a Twitter account that...
Headley raised a hand, silencing her. He slowly wandered behind his desk and sat in his plush, oversized chair. He lowered his head briefly, placing his palms on his forehead before looking up again.
Okay, so I'll never win Father of the Year, he said. But the fact that I have him here working in this administration is to try to make up for the missteps I've made over the years. If he were anyone else, I'd have fired him by now, most likely. He's a bright kid, Richard. He's the most tech-savvy guy I know. Policy, okay, that's not his strong suit. He's too young, doesn't have the experience. Put him somewhere where he shines 24/7, like polling and data analysis. He just did a new hire down there. Liberate him from being part of the inner circle. Let him do his thing without having to make you happy every day.
The mayor appeared to be considering Valerie's words. He looked away and said quietly,
He humiliated me. It took me years to live that down.
Valerie sighed.
You're better than this.
You can bet when and if I announce for anything, they'll dig up that clip of him crying for the cameras.
He was a kid, Valerie said. He was a kid who watched his mother die while you were out.
She stopped herself. Headley gave her a cold stare. Fucking her nurse? Valerie nodded slowly.
I might have put it another way, but yes.
The mayor's face softened. My own father was a son of a bitch.
I know. Treated me like shit.
He shook his head. I hated him. I still hate him. And he's been dead for 16 years, the shit he made me do. But at the same time, I'm grateful, you know?
I think so,
Valerie said. He gave me the strength to make hard decisions.
I had to execute his orders or face his wrath. It made me tough.
He paused, struck by a memory. One time, he made me evict this couple. The husband had lost his job and his wife had just had a baby, had some sort of health complications, but they were 4 months behind in the rent. We were a business, not a charity. They had to go. Valerie looked as though she'd caught wind of a sewage leak.
Jesus. You tell that story like you're proud of it. God help us if that finds its way into your bio.
Headley blinked, as if not realizing how the tale made him look.
Yeah, okay, I take your point.
But it was not the point I was trying to make. I learned to do what had to be done. I grew a spine working for my dad.
Except when it came to standing up to him. You could have said no when he told you to put that family onto the street.
Headley gave his assistant a withering gaze.
She just wasn't getting it. All I'm trying to do with Glover is make him tough, too.
I see,
Valerie said. God, you're looking at me just the way his mother used to, the mayor said. Now it was Valerie's turn to gaze witheringly.
You don't have to make the same mistakes with your own son that your father made with you.
The look he gave her was a mix of contempt and admiration.
You got some balls talking to me this way. If you don't want to hear the truth, Richard, hire someone else.
His mouth slowly morphed into a crooked smile before his face once again turned grim.
Set it up. Oppressor with the chief and that smug asshole from Homeland.
Maybe not Homeland, Valerie advised.
We don't want to scare everyone to death. You put Homeland on stage and we're talking terrorism, no doubt about it.
Headley gave that a thought.
Okay.
And we better bring in what's-his-name, our elevator guy, in case there are any technical questions.
On it, she said.
As she went for the door, it opened. Glover strode into the room.
There's been another one, he said breathlessly. Another elevator tragedy.
Headley looked at his son pityingly, then at Valerie. Breaking news. She gave her boss a sharp, disapproving look that said,
you just can't help yourself, can you?
40. Alexander Veselov, the Russian ambassador to the United States, was walking through Grand Central Terminal when he turned into Hudson News. He perused the front pages of the various newspapers and settled on a copy of the Wall Street Journal. He picked it up, his eye immediately going to a story above the fold about the death of Dr. Fenya Petrov in an elevator mishap. Shouldered into the piece was a one-column sidebar story with the headline, Is It Safe to Ride a City Elevator? He took a $10 bill from his pocket and handed it to the woman behind the counter. Once he'd pocketed his change, he folded the paper once and tucked it under his arm. He did not head back out into the terminal, instead deciding to peruse the periodicals. Hudson News had hundreds of magazines to choose from, as well as a selection of books. Veselov first wandered over to the news magazines. He glanced at the covers of Time and The Economist, leafed through the pages of The New Yorker and read the captions on the cartoons and didn't laugh at a single one. He'd never understood them. He put The New Yorker back and moved to the car section. Articles about cars needed no cultural translation. Veselov reached for a copy of Automobile, lightly bumping shoulders with another man who was glancing through the pages of Motor Trend. The other man was several inches taller than Veselov, and in much better physical shape. Veselov's shoulders were permanently hunched. He was round in the middle and thick in the neck, his skin sickly pale. The other man was lean and trim, tanned, and his black business suit fit him perfectly.
So, Veselov said quietly, his eyes focused on the magazine.
Yes. said the other man, his voice low.
It's done. There's nothing else for you at this time.
Veselov flipped the page, saw an article about an upcoming all-electric Porsche.
If we need you, we'll be in touch. A deposit has been made in the usual account.
You didn't need to do that.
We had a deal. Petrov is no longer a threat.
Yes, but...
Don't protest. We had an arrangement. Things turned out a little differently than expected, but we had the result we wanted. Maybe the next one, you'll give us a discount.
Seems fair,
the other man said.
You have a bit of extra time. See the sights.
The man chuckled.
Maybe not the Empire State Building.
No.
It does not seem like a good week for those kinds of attractions.
You know where I would like to go?
Iowa.
Iowa, said Veselov. Nobody comes to America and goes to Iowa.
You see Field of Dreams? It is my favorite movie.
Veselov shrugged.
Fine. Go to Iowa. See corn.
The ambassador put the car magazine back, turned, and walked away without saying another word. The second man waited the better part of a minute before heading back out into the terminal. A third man, who'd had his back to the other two as he leafed through the pages of a Sports Illustrated, took out his cell phone. He entered a number, placed the phone up to his ear. Someone answered before the first ring had finished. Get me Cartland, he said. 41. Jerry Burke had staked out a spot on Grove Street, leaning up against a tree growing out of the sidewalk between Bedford and Bleecker. Beautiful old brownstones, tall, leafy trees, plenty of interesting shops and cafes and restaurants. Burke had always loved Greenwich Village and wished he lived here. You could almost imagine that you were in a world separate from the rest of New York City. Maybe it was the trees that worked to muffle the horns and sirens and growling engines that were only a block away. Some mornings, like this one, he'd come here before the start of his shift to see how she was doing. Amanda. She would have had her second birthday by now. She was only a year and a half old when her mother, Sasha Woodrow, was shot to death by Blair Evans. Burke had been here enough times to know the routine. The nanny, a young woman in her 20s, would arrive at 7:30 on the dot every morning, Monday to Friday. Sasha's husband, Leslie, would leave roughly 15 minutes later. The front door would open, and Leslie, dressed nattily in suit and tie, would carefully bring out a bike and gingerly roll it down the steps to the sidewalk. He would then mount it and pedal off to his Wall Street job. Burke thought it was foolish of him not to wear a helmet. Amanda had already lost one parent. Why was he willing to take the risk that she might lose two? It was all he could do every morning he was here and saw this, not to say something to him. But he held his tongue. Because if he were Leslie Woodrow, his comeback would be, well, maybe if you hadn't dived out of the way, Amanda wouldn't already be down one parent. Burke surmised that Leslie got Amanda up and dressed, and that he also gave her breakfast, because most mornings that he was there, he witnessed the nanny emerging from the brownstone within 15 minutes of the father's departure. Clearly, there was not enough time for the nanny to accomplish all those things. Burke often imagined Leslie sitting at breakfast with his daughter, sharing a piece of toast with her, giving her some Cheerios to play with, hopeful that more of them would end up in her mouth than on the floor. The nanny, Burke wished he knew her name, and even though he had the skills to find out, he had resisted doing so, liked to take Amanda out for a stroll first thing every morning, unless it was raining. Today was no exception. The door to the brownstone opened, and out came the nanny with Amanda in one arm and a small, folded-up stroller in the other. Once she had locked the door and made her way down to the sidewalk, The nanny set Amanda down briefly and quickly unfolded the stroller before the child could wander off. Once Amanda settled into it, the nanny buckled her in. Very smart, Burke thought. Burke believed the nanny was from France, here on a visa, perhaps. Maybe a student taking courses at night while she worked for Leslie Woodrow through the day. Burke often heard her speaking French to the child as they went past. How nice for Amanda to acquire some proficiency in a second language at such an early age. Too bad about the way it had to happen, of course. Burke was discreet. He kept his distance. He turned away or crossed the street when the nanny approached with the stroller. He knew he shouldn't be spying this way, but Burke needed constant assurance. He needed to know Amanda was okay. He needed to know she was happy, that she was not traumatized, like him. If Amanda happened to be kicking her feet, or babbling cheerfully, or looking at the world with wonder and curiosity, Burke felt hopeful. Those were all good signs, weren't they? If you were consumed with the memory of your mother being shot, of her blood spilling directly onto you like warm red rain, those things would not be possible, right? Burke wanted to believe Amanda had a chance of being a normal, healthy, happy child. Sure, not having a mother put her behind the eight ball from the get-go, but Burke had to believe that eventually she would get past that. And who knew? Perhaps one day Leslie would find someone else. A new wife, a mother for Amanda. Hell, maybe he'd marry the nanny. It had happened before. Burke watched Leslie for signs every morning, too. Those first couple of months, Leslie did not ride his bike. After the arrival of the nanny, and Burke believed the woman had been hired only after the mother's death, he would come down the steps to the street like a dead man walking. He shuffled more than walked. The man was visibly consumed with grief. The next time Burke staked out a spot in the morning, Leslie had the bike. To Burke, the bicycle represented some level of recovery, a desire to face the day with more energy, to embrace it with speed. In fact, as the weeks and months went on, he took off from his Grove Street residence with what struck Burke as enthusiasm. Good, Burke had thought. That's good. Guilt-ridden as he was over the woman's death, he was desperate for evidence that Leslie and Amanda were moving forward. Not that Sasha's death wouldn't haunt them forever. It certainly would Burke. Maybe he was kidding himself. Seeing signs that were not there, in a bid to ease his conscience. He wasn't looking for forgiveness. He had no reason to expect that. But if Leslie and Amanda could build a future together, maybe Burke could breathe a little easier. Literally. As the stroller approached, Burke saw Amanda was playing with something. It was a small rubber airplane, and Amanda was zooming it around, holding it up against the sky, imagining it up there. Her lips vibrated as she mimicked the sounds of the jet engine, the lips that tasted her mother's blood. Burke felt his windpipe tighten. He stood up straight, no longer using the tree to support himself. He reached into his pocket for his inhaler. Just one quick shot, that was all he needed. He uncapped it and brought it up to his mouth. Hey, someone said. Burke brought the inhaler down and shoved it into his pocket as he turned to find the nanny looking at him. Yes, he said. Who are you? She asked. She enunciated perfectly, but her French accent was impossible to miss. I'm sorry. I've seen you before. Are you watching us?
No.
I'm just waiting here to meet a friend. I
know I've seen you. Next time, I'll call the police.
Burke, feeling his air passages constricting further, said,
I am the police.
He quickly flashed his ID.
I'm keeping an eye on someone farther down the street. I'd appreciate it if you didn't say anything.
The nanny's mouth went round in an oh gesture.
Sorry,
she whispered, and moved along red-faced. Burke put the inhaler into his mouth and squeezed. He'd initially thought he only needed one shot, but now he took two. He fumbled as he tried to put it back into his pocket and dropped it instead. He bent over, snatched it up off the sidewalk, and dusted it off before tucking it away. He could never do this again. If the nanny spotted him a second time, he'd have too much explaining to do. The cell phone in his pocket rang. He brought it out, saw who it was, and put the phone to his ear. Yeah, he said. Where are you? Lois Delgado asked. On my way in. Yeah, well, get a move on. We've been reassigned. To what? They're pulling together some kind of task force on the elevator accidents. There's three now.
Three?
Yeah. Two might be coincidence, but three's a clusterfuck. When the captain told them about our auto guy, they pulled us in.
We don't know that there's a connection, he paused.
But we don't know that there isn't. I'm hearing Homeland is involved. Burke said nothing. He looked up the street, saw the nanny and Amanda turn the corner. You there?
Yeah.
I think they must be expecting some kind of panic. The mayor's about to make some kind of statement.
I feel calmer already, Burke said. 42.
Thanks for coming, Mayor Richard Headley said to the gathered media in the press room at City Hall. Valerie had emailed all the usual suspects a release saying the mayor would be making an important statement at noon. She offered no further details. At least a dozen reporters and news editors emailed back, asking what he'd be talking about. Valerie did not respond. That pretty much guaranteed everyone would show up. The room was jammed with reporters, print, network, radio. Many of them were chatting, asking each other if they had any idea what was going on. Valerie provided a short introduction that amounted to little more than, Mayor Richard Headley, before turning over the podium to her boss. Standing well off to the side were Glover and Valens. On stage with the mayor were Police Chief Annette Washington and Martin Fleck, the elevator expert. The mayor cleared his throat after his thank you and welcome, and took a drink of water from a glass left for him on the podium. He was about to speak when someone shouted out a question. Was the taxi explosion terrorism related? The question appeared to throw off the mayor before he'd had a chance to begin reading from his prepared text. That one reporter's question was a dam burster. Others began shouting questions. How many were killed in the explosion? Was the driver a terrorist? Is this a suicide bombing? Was the bomb left in the car by a passenger? The mayor held up a hand and waited until everyone had quieted down. Any questions about the taxi incident, I will leave for Chief Washington here. Right now, I'm going to address another potential concern for the citizens of New York. As you know, there have been three tragic incidents involving elevators in the last 3 days. The first, on Monday, claimed four lives, including well-known entertainment producer Sherry D'Agostino and lawyer Barton Fieldgate. A terrible loss to the city and to their families. At the time, it was believed some sort of random malfunction was the cause. But then, on Tuesday, another elevator incident took the life of a renowned Russian scientist, Vanya Petrov, who was here doing work at Rockefeller University. I have been in contact with the Russian ambassador and assured him we are doing everything we can to find out what happened. But even before I could make much headway there, we had another incident this morning in which two people were killed. A stirring went through the crowd. Headley said, "We have reason to suspect that these three incidents are not coincidental and are, in fact, related." "How?" shouted one reporter. "I'm getting to that," the mayor said, giving the reporter a harsh, "shut the fuck up and let me finish" look. "Without getting into the details, there is a commonality to all these events that has raised our concern level. So,
I have directed the city's inspection force to begin a comprehensive check of all elevators in all 5 boroughs. Needless to say, this is a time-consuming task, so we are asking for the assistance of property management departments to initiate their own inspections. The assembled media was getting increasingly restless. Another reporter shouted out, "So are we talking a mechanical issue here? Some failed part that's in lots of different elevators across the city? And if so, why are the failures happening at the same time?" "This is the sort of thing we're looking into," Headley said, irritated. The constant interruptions were throwing him off his game. "I can say that my information is that the FBI or Homeland Security are involved, which would be kind of weird if it's just a mechanical issue." A different voice. Female. Headley squinted, trying to see past the lights to spot who had asked the question. "Would that be Ms. Matheson?" "Yes," said Barbara. "Am I wrong about that? That the feds have taken an interest?" The mayor paused a moment. "DHS is involved, yes," he said slowly. "Was it Homeland Security, then, that was going to the families of the deceased and asking them to keep a low profile? To not ask too many questions, at least at this stage?" "I'm not in a position to answer that," Headley said. "We'd need someone from Homeland to field that." "Is it because they didn't want to cause a panic before they had more details?" "I'd encourage you to give them a call." "Oh, I've been trying," Barbara said. "Wouldn't Homeland's involvement suggest what you're dealing with here is, in fact, terrorism? That these elevator malfunctions are actually sabotage, that they're deliberate acts?" The buzz that was moving through the room began to grow louder. A reporter from the Daily News shouted out, "If this is deliberate, who's doing it? Has anyone claimed responsibility?" The mayor looked to Chief Washington. She nodded and stepped forward to the microphone. "No one has claimed responsibility," she said. "And just to clarify what the mayor was saying, we do not know with 100% certainty that there was deliberate tampering, but we are seriously looking at that possibility." "Is this related to the flyovers?" asked a woman from Fox News. "We have no reason to..." "Because," she continued, "someone claiming to be inspired by them just claimed responsibility for the taxi bombing. It's on Twitter." Washington blinked. Everyone in the room turned to look at the woman from Fox. "I'm not familiar with that tweet," Washington said, grimacing. "Twitter is not my number one news source." "Is it possible the explosion and the elevator incident at the Gormley building on 7th Avenue are linked? They happened at exactly the same time." "Again, that will be part of our investigation. We're in the very early stages. I'd like to turn it back over to the mayor." The mayor resumed his spot at the podium and said, "Thank you, Chief. Moving on, I'd like to point out that, is it safe to take an elevator in this city?" It was Barbara's question. The room went silent as everyone waited for the mayor's answer. But instead of doing that, the mayor turned to Fleck and waved him forward. I'd like to introduce Martin Fleck from the Department of Buildings. He can speak to the issue of elevator safety and deal with the more technical questions." As Fleck approached the mic, the mayor whispered, "Try to keep it upbeat." Fleck gave him a sharp look as if to say, "Seriously?" But as he stood before the podium, he did his best to project calm.
"To address that last question," he said, "the facts bear out that elevators are very, very safe. Accidents are extremely rare. In fact, most fatalities related to elevators involve servicemen, not the general public. There are many safety features built into any elevator system that..." A woman from the Post cut him off. "Yeah, but we're not talking about that kind of thing. We're talking about terrorists cutting the cables." Fleck held up a palm to the crowd. "No one said anything about cutting cables, and no one up here used the word terrorist. The cables were not, as you say, cut on these elevators."
"Then what did happen?"
Fleck said, "It's more like they were hacked."
There was a sudden eruption of questions. With everyone shouting queries at once, Fleck looked like a bunny cornered by a wolf pack.
"How?"
Barbara managed to shout over the others.
"Do you hack an elevator? Is that actually possible?" "Well, it would be very difficult," Fleck said. It would demand a very high level of expertise, and even if you had that kind of knowledge, you would need a device that... What kind of device?
It was the woman from the Post again.
In simplest terms, it's like a TV remote that allows one to control all of an elevator's functions.
The guy from New York One said, That sounds like something out of a Mission Impossible movie. You can't do that in the real world, can you?
If you knew all the various security codes, yes, in fact, you can. It can be plugged right into a building's elevator system. Now, if someone were outside the building and knew how to access the overall security system, one could then tap into the elevator system.
Fleck, now that he was really getting into his area of expertise, was starting to look more comfortable, but Headley appeared increasingly uneasy.
Holy shit!
One of the reporters exclaimed. A tall, handsome man from the local NBC affiliate finally got a question in.
But a device like that would be very hard to get hold of, wouldn't it?
In fact, said Fleck, no, you can buy one for about $500 on...
The mayor came up alongside Fleck and edged him away from the microphone. Thanks very much, Martin. I'll take it from here.
The reason I called this news conference was to inform the public that we are investigating all of these incidents very carefully and asking that if anyone sees something that is remotely suspicious to please alert.
Barbara called out, Excuse me. The mayor ignored her.
What we are imploring people to do is, I had a question that never got answered, Barbara said, making herself heard above the mayor.
Headley, looking visibly pained, looked at Barbara and asked,
What question was that?
Barbara took half a second to compose herself, then said, sounding out each word clearly and succinctly,
Is it, or is it not, safe to take an elevator in the city of New York?
The mayor looked grim. Everyone in the room seemed to be holding their breath.
I don't know, he said finally.
43. Within minutes of the mayor's I don't know, the story was the lead item on all city, state, and national newscasts. CNN interrupted regular programming with its breaking news logo, and a grim-faced Wolf Blitzer told the world how the mayor of one of the biggest and most vertical cities in the world could not say with any assurance whatsoever that the city's thousands of elevators were safe.
After three elevator tragedies in as many days, Blitzer said, New York is now facing the possibility of a serial saboteur. There is evidence to suggest that all three incidents in random buildings across the city are connected. Stunningly, it was revealed moments ago that these elevators may have been hacked, raising the horrifying specter that these conveyances that carry millions of people every day could be remotely manipulated. This startling news comes at the same time as the flyovers, a militant domestic group believed to be responsible for terrorist acts in several coastal cities, has claimed responsibility for a taxi bombing in New York that claimed not only the life of the driver, but two visitors from Canada who had just stepped out of a hotel on East 49th Street. The head of the New York Police Department could not say one way or another whether the flyovers group is actually behind the taxi bombing or if it has a hand in the elevator crisis.
The New York Times website updated within minutes of Mayor Richard Headley's news conference. Its banner headline read, Elevator plunges linked, sabotage suspected. Below that ran a secondary headline, Mayor Headley fails to calm a nervous city. The New York Daily News, predictably, was less subtle about the mayor's inability to reassure his constituents that it was safe to get into a city elevator. Paired with a picture of the mayor looking glumly down at his notes was the headline, Nice going, Dick. Followed by a secondary headline reading, Headcase doesn't know if hacked elevator's safe. Immediately after the news conference, with two thumbs working at lightning speed, Barbara wrote a column on her phone and emailed it to her editor at Manhattan Today. It was posted to the website less than a minute later under the headline,
mayor gives city the shaft when it comes to elevator safety. By Barbara Matheson. In what has to go down in the books as one of the most disastrous press conferences in New York City history, an inept Mayor Richard Hedley told the city two startling things. The first was that someone, or some group, is deliberately killing New Yorkers by taking over the operation of elevators with malicious intent. But, as troubling as that news is, the second tidbit is worse. Our mayor hasn't got a clue what to do about it. Appearing with the chief of police and a flunky from the city department that oversees elevator safety, the mayor offered a blunt, "I don't know," when asked whether you can get into one of these devices and expect to get out of it alive. Consider what has happened since Monday. 4 dead when an elevator in the Lansing Tower plunged. A visiting Russian scientist beheaded as she attempted to escape her car when it was stuck with the doors open between floors. And early this morning, 2 people crushed to death in the Gormley building after they fell into the bottom of the shaft and the car came down on top of them. What may happen tomorrow? And what plan, if any, does the city have to deal with this? As if that weren't enough to worry about, a New York cab blew up this morning, killing at least 3 people. But don't ask the mayor if that has anything to do with the elevator mishaps, because he doesn't know. What we do know is that someone claiming to be part of the Flyovers activist group posted on Twitter to claim responsibility for the bombing. Maybe they'd have copped to the elevator sabotage too, but ran out of characters. So, bottom line is, we don't know whether it's safe to ride in an elevator or a taxi. Have a nice day. The hashtag going down, started trending on Twitter within 10 minutes of Hedley's remarks. And then, big news broke. Media outlets were alerted to a second City Hall press conference less than an hour after the first one. Mayor Hedley, instantly feeling the heat about not knowing how to respond to the crisis, issued a statement that he was, after consultation with the city's police and fire chiefs, ordering that every elevator in the city be taken out of service until it could be determined that they were safe. Every single one. But rather than face the press again after his disastrous earlier appearance, Hedley sent someone to speak on his behalf. His son. A nervous Glover Hedley took to the podium to say that the city was calling on landlords and property managers everywhere to make their elevators inoperable until they could be inspected and deemed safe. And by safe, he meant not tampered with. Instructions on how to determine whether they had been would be posted on the city's website so as to expedite the process. Among other things, inspectors would be told to look for unauthorized modifications to the cars and to change any passwords into building and elevator security systems. Glover said the mayor appreciated the magnitude of the inconvenience this would pose to the people of New York, but he was hopeful the measure would be short-lived. Inspections were to start immediately. And it was possible many elevators would be back in operation by the end of the week, many much sooner. The non-news networks canceled regular programming to give the story blanket coverage. "This is an outrageous overreaction," said one male political commentator on CNN, part of a Hollywood Squares-like cluster of pundits. "You simply cannot shut down every elevator in the biggest city in the country. We have no idea how real this threat is, and chances are more people will get hurt not being able to use elevators than might be hurt in them. This is like shutting down every road in America because there might be a couple of weak bridges out there somewhere." A woman in the box next to him shot back, "Are you kidding me? Would you get on an elevator in New York today?" The man shot back angrily, "Yes, I would. And you know why? Because this is all a load of fake news designed to frighten people and make them submit to the will of..." Another man in the box above him cut in and said,
For the love of God, that's just about the stupidest thing I've ever heard from you, and that's saying something. Every time you're warned about a possible threat, you think it's some conspiracy to make you submit? Come on, what are you? Oh, the first man shot back. And I suppose you think 9/11 wasn't an inside job. Well, I have it on good authority. On Fox, the conspiracy theories went even further, where one guest speculated that the mayor, with his left-leaning Democratic background, had manufactured the crisis as a way to make New Yorkers more fit by forcing them to take the stairs. After all, this was the same mayor who wanted all the city vehicles to be emissions-free. Could you really trust someone like that? This is the most ridiculous thing since former Mayor Michael Bloomberg tried to legislate the size of soft drinks, the guest said. Over on NBC, a so-called expert had been brought into the studio to tell viewers how to survive an elevator plunge. She said, "A lot of people think if you're in an elevator that's hurtling downward and you jump off the floor just before it hits the bottom of the shaft, that somehow that's going to save you. Well," and at this point she chuckled, "there's a whole lot wrong with that supposition. The first is, you're not really going to be able to time it right. You can be looking at the numbers next to the door and figure, okay, we're just about to hit the basement, jump now, but even if you could do that, which is pretty much impossible, it wouldn't save you. Your body is still traveling downward at the same rate of speed as the elevator, so one way or another, you're going to hit bottom and you're going to hit it hard. The only real hope you have of surviving is to lie down on the floor of the elevator on your back, spreading out your arms and legs like you're a starfish. What this does is more evenly distribute your weight across the surface of the elevator floor." The host asked, "Okay, but what if you're in an elevator with 10 other people and can't do that?" The expert shrugged. "Well, in that case, you're going to become elevator pizza." On MSNBC, the elevator crisis was a financial story. "The New York Stock Exchange has closed 3 hours before the ringing of the bell," one analyst said. "The business of the city has effectively ground to a halt. Millions of dollars are being lost every second that this goes on. Mayor Richard Hedley has created a panic. He needs to get back out there in front of the cameras and come up with something better than I don't know, and we're shutting down the elevators. This has to be the most astonishing example of incompetence I have ever seen." The only group alleged to have taken responsibility for anything that had happened in New York in the previous 3 days was the U.S.-based flyovers. And even its connection to the taxi bombing had not been independently confirmed. But that did not stop many individuals, including more than a few politicians at very senior levels, from arguing that this was more evidence that America needed to curb immigration and tighten its borders. "We cannot," said one bombastic talk radio host, "allow these illegals into our country to wage war on us. But yet, that's what we do. Just how stupid are we, ladies and gentlemen?" Nearly every TV channel, with the possible exceptions of those devoted to weather updates, cartoons, and repeats of The Big Bang Theory, was featuring non-stop talking heads offering plenty of opinions based on almost no information whatsoever. In that sense, it was pretty much like any other day. 44. Barbara had not left the City Hall media room after the mayor's statement. She'd taken a chair in a back corner, sat down, and written her piece with her two amazing thumbs. The room had pretty much cleared out, but reporters started filing back in when word got out that the mayor's son was going to make a follow-up statement. So Barbara was already sitting there when Glover went to the podium to announce the mayor's decision to shut down all city elevators.
"Holy shit,"
Barbara said under her breath. The magnitude of this story was growing exponentially by the hour. She wasn't surprised Hedley had sent the boy to deliver this latest bulletin. The mayor had done enough damage to himself in his earlier appearance when,
In response to Barbara's question, he could not say whether it was safe to ride a New York elevator. Glover's statement had pretty much made it clear that the answer was no. Glover declined to take questions after making the announcement, but as he tried to escape the room, he was cornered by several news crews and reporters shouting out more questions. He kept raising his hand in front of his face, as much to keep the blinding lights out of his eyes as to keep the media hounds at bay. Barbara saw nothing to be gained by joining the scrum. No reporter ever got an exclusive by following the pack. She glanced out the media room door and spotted Chris Valens's bald head. He was walking speedily, as though he wanted to distance himself from the chaos as quickly as possible. Barbara chased after him. When she was within a couple of feet, she reached out and grabbed his arm, spinning him around. His startled expression lasted only until he realized who it was that had a hold on him.
"Hey," she said, "tell me, just how bad is this?"
He glanced about nervously.
"You're the last person I should be seen talking to."
Barbara turned her head to the closest door. A sign screwed to it that read "Ladies." She hooked her arm deeper into his and dragged him toward it.
"You gotta be kidding," he said.
By the time he got his arm free, they were already inside, in an area with some cushioned chairs ahead of where the room opened up and the stalls could be found. Barbara pushed Chris into a chair and dropped into one next to it.
"Spill," she said.
"I've got nothing to say," he told her as he turned his head to the door, clearly worried that another woman might walk in at any moment.
"How big is this? Who's behind it?" she asked.
"They don't have any idea," he said.
"What about these flyover nuts?"
Valens shrugged. "They're looking at them, but no one really knows anything."
"What's connecting the elevator events? Is there some commonality?"
Valens pressed his lips tightly together as though conducting an inner debate.
"Okay. I shouldn't be telling you this, but..."
"Come on," she said anxiously.
"Cameras," he said.
"Cameras?"
"Someone installed tiny cameras to monitor what was happening in the elevators that killed people."
Barbara's eyes went wide.
"Jesus. Why would someone do that?"
Another shrug.
"Maybe to see that someone was inside before making them go haywire. No sense dropping an elevator if there's no one inside to fuck with," he sighed. "You really made Headley look like a fool in there."
"He doesn't make it that hard. What else can you tell me?"
"Nothing. I shouldn't even have told you that much, but it's going to come out. Landlords are being told what to look for. They see one of those cameras mounted on top of an elevator, they know it's an elevator that might be targeted."
"This is insane," Barbara said.
"Why would anyone do this?"
"You can be sure there's a reason," Valens said. "And I'm betting that eventually it'll come out." Barbara said,
"You have my number?"
"Oh, I think everyone's got your number."
"Fuck off, my phone number."
"I've got it, and your email."
"How'd you get that?"
Valens gave her a duh look.
"It's at the end of your column."
"Oh, right."
She rolled her eyes at her stupidity.
"If there's anything else you can tell me, off the record, get in touch."
"Don't hold your breath."
His face softened as he asked,
"How's the elbow?"
"Aches like a motherfucker," Barbara said with a hint of a smile. "But it's fine."
The door started to swing open. A woman took one step in and stopped when she saw Chris. Before he could say anything, Barbara pointed to the hall and said, "Find another one." The woman disappeared. Chris said,
"You really are a piece of work."
"You're not so bad yourself.
And I still say you were following me." Chris poked the inside of his cheek with his tongue.
"Lucky for you, or you wouldn't be here now, being a pain in the ass."
She eyed him slyly.
"He's got you checking up on me, looking for some way to discredit me."
"I'm not saying that's true," Chris said. "But even if it was, I think he's got bigger things to worry about now."
"So I better stop looking at my phone when I cross the street then? My guardian angel is otherwise engaged."
"Something like that," he said.
"Too bad,"
Barbara said.
The sound of a text came from inside his jacket. He dug out the phone, looked at the message, grimaced.
What?
They need me, he said, then rolled his eyes. The mayhem has begun. 45. Ahmad Connor, 14 years old, and his friend Jeremy Blakelock, who had turned 15 the week before, were pulling the same stunt they'd pulled several times before. They had both left their Hell's Kitchen apartment building after breakfast, supposedly on their way to a full day of school where they were both in the ninth grade. Their parents, Ahmad lived with both of his, but Jeremy lived with his mother during the week and then went to live with his father in Brooklyn most weekends, always left for work later. Ahmad's dad was employed in the massive shoe department at Macy's, while his mother was a secretary for a condo development firm in the Upper West Side. Jeremy's mother was the head dayside chef for a restaurant just off Union Square. Ahmad and Jeremy actually showed up for homeroom when attendance would be taken, but they vanished on their way to first period. That way, it would take longer for school officials to figure out they were absent, at which point there was a chance they would call their parents and ask where they were. But they also knew from past experience that often the school didn't make that call. After all, they were teenagers. They weren't some kindergarten toddlers who'd failed to show up. So what if they didn't get to class? Odds were they hadn't been kidnapped. With an entire city at their disposal, one might have thought they'd explore it. Ride the subways, go to Midtown Comics and steal some graphic novels, then hit the multiplex and take in the latest adventure featuring the stars of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But they did none of these things. They headed home. They were going to surf. From watching various YouTube videos, the two had learned that once you were inside an elevator, if you kept the doors open, looped a wire over a small bracket tucked in the upper corner where the doors retracted, and pulled down on it, the outer doors would remain open even after the elevator had moved on. So they'd send the elevator one floor down, jump out, and once the elevator had stopped one floor below, step through the opening and stand atop the car. To cover their tracks, they would make sure the door closed behind them. Later, when the elevator stopped for long enough, they would pry open the doors one floor above the car and leap out. Up and down the shaft they'd go. They had no control over the elevator at this point. That would be determined by whoever got on it, and it was the unpredictability that made it so much fun. The elevator would be summoned to a floor, but which one? Someone would board, but where would they want to go? Whispering back and forth so as not to alert anyone they were there, they would take bets on where they might end up. They'd recorded some of their earlier adventures on their phones and posted them anonymously to YouTube. The site was filled with this kind of stuff. They only wished they lived in an even taller building so they could go on longer, wilder rides. It sure beat school. Except that afternoon, something odd happened. It seemed that no one needed the elevator. They had been sitting on the roof of the car at the top of the shaft, crouched below the ceiling and above the exit to the 25th floor without a door beside them to crack open. 10 minutes had gone by, and they had not moved, and they could hear neither of the other elevators moving either. That had never happened before. "What the fuck?" Jeremy said to Ahmad. Ahmad said, "Maybe there was a fire drill and everyone's outside." "There was no fire alarm, dipshit," Jeremy said. After 20 minutes, they started to get worried. Jeremy suggested they open the escape hatch on the top of the car. If they could get into it and hit the elevator buttons, they could probably get out. But the hatch did not lift off. It was bolted on. And they had not exactly brought along a toolkit. They did not want to get caught on top of the car. They'd be in trouble,
not just with the building management, but their parents. All the other times they'd elevator surfed, they'd gotten away with it. But at the half-hour mark, they started shouting.
Help!
They cried together.
Help us! We're in here! Somebody get us out!
No one heard them. Connie Boyle's phone buzzed. It was screen side down on her desk at an investment firm in one of the uppermost floors of One World Trade Center, the tallest building in the Western Hemisphere, sixth tallest in the world. Although technically 104 stories tall, there were only 94 actual stories. And when Connie chose to look out the window, which was not often, she felt overwhelmed by the view. And not in a good way. It had taken Connie, 43, a long time to get used to the idea of working up here in the clouds. First of all, she was uncomfortable with heights. It wasn't a totally crippling fear, but it was bad enough that she had insisted, when her firm moved here, on a workstation well inside the building away from the windows. She could go entire weeks without ever looking outside. Her friends would say to her, "Wow, how cool to work up there. Do you ever get tired of that view?" "What view?" she often replied. Connie's anxiety about working here was not due solely to her uneasiness with heights. One World Trade Center had been erected on the site of the old World Trade Center. Connie could never get over the fear that the new building was a target. Whenever she heard a passing jet, she felt a wave of anxiety. She felt relief at the end of every day when she put her feet back down on Fulton Street. Her phone buzzed, and she saw that it was her husband. When he asked her in a panicked tone, before she'd even had a chance to say hello, whether she was okay, her heart began to race, and she almost instantly began to feel faint and dizzy.
"Why?"
she asked. "The elevators," he said. "Have they shut down your elevators?" She had no idea what he was talking about. But before she could ask him what he knew that she did not, a woman's voice came over the building's public address system.
"May I have your attention, please?" she said.
Connie's dizziness intensified. Her heart was a jackhammer.
"Oh, my God," she said. "Oh, my God." "It's going to be okay," her husband said. "I just wanted to be sure you were..."
Connie was half listening to her husband, half listening to the voice emanating from the speakers.
"They're shutting down the elevators," she whispered. We can't use the elevators. We're stuck up here. We're sitting ducks."
She dropped the phone onto her desk as she stood up out of her chair. She looked over the partitions to the north window.
"We're trapped," she said.
Her voice grew louder and shakier.
"We have to get out of here. We have to get out."
Several co-workers leapt from their chairs and gathered around Connie, attempting to console her. But the woman was in the throes of a full-scale panic attack.
Connie, it's okay," said one woman. "It's just a precaution. Yeah, we've got a long walk down the stairs to get home, but..."
But Connie didn't hear her. She had passed out and collapsed on the floor. Retired librarian Zachary Carrick went to Zabar's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Zachary bought only as much as he could carry. Like many New Yorkers, he did not drive. Unlike most New Yorkers, he did not like to take taxis and hated the subway. If Zachary was going to go someplace, it had to be within walking distance, which meant that Zachary pretty much never left the Upper West Side. His world these days had become limited to roughly a 9-square-block area. Zabar's was only around the corner at Broadway and 80th. He liked to walk, but he didn't like to walk far. So Zachary would buy what he needed for 2 days. On Fridays, he would buy a little extra to get him through to Monday. It wasn't just that Zachary Carrick only purchased what he could carry. He figured, at the age of 87, he didn't want to buy too much food if there was a chance he might not get the chance to consume it. This worried him most on Fridays. Suppose, he often thought to himself, I popped my clog Friday night, and I've gone and bought enough provisions to get me through the entire weekend. What a waste of money that would be. Zachary had been on his own since his wife Glenda passed away nearly 20 years ago. But he had never left their 18th floor apartment on West 81st. Why move? The place wasn't huge to begin with. Why mess with a perfectly good routine? Although he'd spent a career surrounded by newspapers and periodicals filled with current events, Zachary didn't give a rat's ass about what went on anymore. He didn't get any papers and almost never turned on his TV unless it was to watch what he called the lobby channel, where he could see who was coming in and out of the building. Out of the hundreds of channels available to him, this was, without question, the best reality show on TV. Zachary was not prepared for what awaited him upon his return to the building today. There were out-of-order signs taped to all three elevators. A dozen other residents were milling about in the lobby, grousing about the inconvenience. Most of them were, as Zachary himself might say, getting on. A few of them were even as old as he was. One of them was Mrs. Attic, who was in a wheelchair. She looked the most distressed of any of them.
"What the hell is going on?"
he asked, setting down his two Zabar's bags. Even though they weren't that heavy, his arms felt like they were going to pop out of their sockets. The other residents quickly brought him up to speed.
"It was Headley gave the order," one man said. "Shut them all down, all over the city."
"That son of a bitch," Zachary said. "How the hell am I supposed to get upstairs? I can't walk up to 18. I'll be dead before I get to 10.
Mrs. Attic said,
"What about Griffin?"
"Who?"
"My cat. The super said there's no way to know how long this is going to go on. Could be hours or it could be days. Who's going to feed Griffin?"
Zachary hated cats and didn't much care what happened to Mrs. Attic's. He just wanted to get back up to his apartment where he could watch what was happening here on his TV while he made himself some coffee.
"My daughter came and took me to lunch,"
Mrs. Attic said in her high-pitched voice,
"but she dropped me off without knowing what had happened. She would have gone up and fed Griffin. She works out 4 days a week. She could have run up those stairs like it was nothing. Griffin's going to be worried sick."
Zachary was more worried about his yogurt. He needed to get it into the refrigerator. He was about to go hunting for the super when the main doors flew open, and in came two male paramedics, one short, one tall, with a wheeled gurney. They looked frustrated but not shocked when they saw the out-of-order signs.
"Did you reach the super?"
the short one said into the small radio attached to a strap just below his chin. "We need to work an elevator." His radio crackled. "On his way," a voice said through static.
"Yes," said Zachary under his breath. They'd have to get the elevators operational if there was a medical emergency somewhere in the upper reaches of the building.
Seconds later, the superintendent, a heavy-set, olive-skinned man, came into the lobby from a nearby stairwell door.
"You gotta get one of these going," the paramedic said.
"Yeah, yeah," the super said. "I just got the middle one back on. It's Mr. Gilbert and 15C on 15.
A stir of excitement from the residents. What a break that Mr. Gilbert was having another one of his heart attacks. The super hit the up button, and the center elevator doors opened. But Mrs. Attic had already positioned herself close to them, and when they parted, she wheeled herself in like someone trying out for the Paralympic Games.
"Lady," the tall paramedic shouted, "get out of the way! My cat!" she cried.
She hadn't yet turned around, so the shorter paramedic was able to grab the handles on the back of her chair. But as he attempted to pull the wheelchair back out, Mrs. Attic grabbed the railing on the elevator wall. That only slowed the paramedic for half a second, who yanked harder. Everyone heard a snap. Mrs. Attic screamed,
"My wrist! Oh, God, my wrist!"
At which point, Zachary wondered if they would treat her first right here in the lobby, which would allow him to use the elevator to get to his apartment and put his yogurt into the fridge. It did not work out that way. They got Mrs. Attic out of the elevator, tipped the gurney up on one end, hit
15 on the pad, and up they went. They were too late. Mr. Gilbert was dead, and had been for the better part of half an hour. As was Zachary Carrick, who had decided what the hell he would make the climb. He was rounding the stairwell by the door to the fifth floor when his heart exploded. The good news was a sixth-floor tenant, Grant Rydell, 23, an unemployed Broadway actor,